Hello and welcome to another edition of Digital Flotsam. I'm P.W. Fenton. This edition of Digital Flotsam features several true stories with a unifying theme. All of them have something to do with foolishness, either being fooled or feeling foolish. They are gathered together here in all of their foolish glory. The first story is a tale about the pain of being young and looking foolish.
My stepson Josh recently announced to his mother, my wife Linda, that he doesn't plan on walking in his upcoming high school graduation ceremony. He says it's a lot of time and money to spend on something that, after all, isn't really that big of a thrill. Of course, Linda, being a mom, tried to dissuade him on the grounds that she really wants to see him in his cap and gown. Unfortunately for her, Josh had already run his plan by me, and I had said, "Good for you! Why be a conformist? I support you wholeheartedly in your decision." I hadn't meant to undermine my wife's maternal photo op, but I did it for a good reason. You see, I decided long ago that children should never do things just to make their parents happy. It all started in the fifth grade. While other kids were jonesing their parents for mini bikes, ponies, and all kinds of unreasonably dangerous and expensive gifts, I had one very simple and affordable wish: a pair of blue jeans. All the other kids had them, but I was forced to wear double knits to school because my parents believed that denim was the fabric of Satan. According to my dad, proof of its undeniable evil lay in two telltale facts. One, that the Fonz wore denim pants and he was a hoodlum. And two, worse than that, hippies wore them. Never mind that he told me this when most of the hippies had traded in their bell bottoms for Armani suits. To my dad's mind, hippies were still the number one threat to our honest, wholesome, God-fearing, flag-loving American lifestyle. The Beatles, he once told me, were singularly responsible for the impending fall of Western civilization. The communist victory in the Cold War was virtually assured the moment Lennon sang, "All you need is love," and wearing blue jeans was only adding fuel to the fire. My mom agreed with him, but sympathized with my desire to look as cool as the other kids. Her solution was to make me a pair of pants that looked sorta denim-y, but would also look undenim-y enough to make it clear that I wasn't contributing to the moral decline of the free world. I thought it was a great idea. Until I saw the pants she made for me. The material was much thinner than denim and reminded me of the kind of fabric that was used to make pajamas. The main color was a dark blue that did, in some way, look like denim, but the pattern overlaid on the blue was horrific. The pants were covered from belt line to cuff in chiclets. Every 10 inches, there was a chiclet box open at the top and tipped over so its colorful contents spewed out onto the blue. My heart sank as I realized I would go to school with my lower body festooned in chiclet cornucopias. And, to make matters worse, my mom wasn't nearly the homemaker she had always wanted to be. This was her first pair of pants, and so, naturally, she thought it would be okay to cut a few corners. For example, the pants had no pockets, fly, or belt loops. Instead, they had a super tight elastic waistband that bunched the material at the belt line, creating a ruffle that looked like a clown's collar. I knew I was in for a beating, because even though I really didn't want to wear the elastic chiclet pants to school, I could see how much it meant to my mom, And sure enough, I got beat up before I even got to school. I was the only book-smart, well-behaved Puritan boy in a hard-drinking redneck neighborhood. The bus stop was always hell for me. But on that day, it was much worse. The Skaggs brothers, I'm not kidding, that was their name, threw me in the creek the moment they laid eyes on my shamelessly fruity pants. It was a cold day, and I was soaking wet, but I vowed not to go home because I still wanted my mom to feel good about her handiwork. I stayed in my desk as much as I could, hoping to hide my pants from public scrutiny, but it didn't work. News of my hideous pants spread through the school so quickly that kids on the playground and in the lunchroom sought me out specifically to ridicule me. The pants dried by the time school let out, but it didn't matter. The Skaggs brothers threw me in the creek again at the end of the day. When I got home, I put the chiclet pants in the laundry. I wore them at home from time to time just to make my mom feel good, but I never wore them to school again, and I never again asked for blue jeans. From time to time, I was tempted to blame my parents for the trauma, but the truth is, I did it to myself. I could have stood up for what I really wanted, but I didn't. And so now, as a father, I have a firm policy of not making my kids do something just because it'll make me happy. I just hope they don't realize this, because they're going to look so cute in the little sailor outfits I bought them for the graduation ceremony.
I should tell you that I hate dentists. I hate doctors. I hate having anyone fuss over me, even a barber. But I digress. I hate dentists. It's a cold winter day in New York. I've awakened on this particular morning with an intense toothache that I just can't will away. It's a Saturday. You just don't see a dentist on a Saturday. I make scores of phone calls before I finally find someone who will see me. I arrive at the dentist's office after driving several miles. I walk up a long, narrow flight of stairs, and after hanging up my wool navy peacoat on the coat rack in the foyer, I take my seat in the waiting room. I look around the room and I see faces that somehow look even more nervous than me. They must all have emergencies of their own. One little girl looks absolutely terrified. They call my name. Mr. Fenton! I rise to my feet. If my tooth had felt even one micro bit better than when I first arrived, I would have left and been on my way home. But that was not the case. My tooth hurt so bad that it was all I could do to keep from moaning. Nothing less could have brought me to the dentist's office in the first place. An attractive nurse prepares me and clips a paper bib around my neck. She goes through the routine motions of taking x-ray pictures of my teeth and then leaves the room. Eventually, the dentist enters the room. He says,
"Looks like we got a bit of a problem here."
I've never seen him before in my life, and I already hate him.
"I'm afraid that tooth is going to have to come out," he says.
"Fine," I say. "Anything that will stop the pain. I wouldn't be here if I could stop the pain myself."
"You know, you really should take better care of your teeth," he says.
"I'm not here for a lecture. I'm here because I am desperate. I am here because I am experiencing enough pain to make a grown man cry." He produces a stainless steel instrument of torture and begins poking around in my mouth.
"Yup, this can't be saved. This tooth has got to come out."
With that, he takes this stainless steel instrument and directly stabs the offending tooth. With spectacular fireworks going off in my field of vision, my only reply is, "Rrr." He straps a plastic mask to my face and then walks over to a large cylinder and begins turning a valve. He tells me I should breathe deeply and that I should tell him when I begin to feel a tingly sensation in my lips or my hands.
I've never had it before, but I know this must be nitrous oxide, so-called laughing gas. I am very eager to be in a laughing mood, so I dutifully follow the dentist's instructions. I breathe very deeply, waiting to feel myself drift into oblivion. I do quite a bit of this deep breathing. Nothing is happening to me. No tingling, nothing. My tooth still hurts like the blazes, and I'm still nervous and terrified. The dentist says,
"Are you feeling it?"
I say, "No."
The dentist says, "This is no joke. I'm not here so you hippies can get a buzz on. I have work to do."
And with that, he takes the mask off my face. I swear to you, I never felt the slightest effect of the gas. Years later, I learned that some unfortunate people are simply immune to the effects of nitrous oxide. I am apparently one of those people. The dentist reached into my mouth with a set of strange, twisted-looking needle-nose pliers and clamped down on the offending tooth. The fireworks display returned. He warned me that he was going to press down hard on the tooth. I obliged this warning by sinking so low in the chair that my head must have been lying on the seat. His warning was probably a lie designed to make me do exactly what I did, which was to pull against his efforts to yank the tooth. Some excruciating crunching noises later, and the tooth was out. I remember the look of dismay on the dentist's face as he said,
"Are you all right? You've lost all the color in your face."
He called the attractive nurse into the room and said,
"Take him to room C and give him some oxygen."
I started down the hall, guided by the nurse, when I said,
"I think I'm going to be sick."
The nurse quickly steered me into a doorway and swung my head over a sink. I began proving what I just said. In the background, I hear the dentist's voice yelling,
"No! No! Not in my new darkroom sink!"
Eventually, I pulled myself together and went out to the desk where the nurse told me how much I owed the dentist for this wonderful experience. I opened my checkbook and began to write out a check. As I was writing, I had the strangest feeling. Of course, it doesn't make any sense at all, but I was overwhelmed with the urge to take a nap. It seemed like a perfectly good time to do it. So without saying anything, I bent over and rested my forehead on the checkbook and instantly lost consciousness. The next thing I know, I'm in the hallway again, and the dentist, with his arms wrapped around my chest from behind, is dragging me past the various doorways. I distinctly remember seeing the horrified face of the little girl I had seen earlier in the waiting room as the dentist dragged my limp body past the door. A half a tank of oxygen later, and all I wanted to do was leave. I was so dreadfully embarrassed by the whole experience that if I could have simply dematerialized, I would have. Once I finally convinced the terrified dentist and his nurse that I was okay, they allowed me to get out of the chair. I raced into the waiting room. A crowd of waiting patients stared at me wide-eyed as I burst into the room, put on my coat, and ran down the stairs to leave the building. As I ran down the stairs, I noticed something very disturbing. I felt an enormous pressure on my chest. It was a tightness, and it was making it difficult to breathe. "Oh no," I thought, "am I having a heart attack?" I instinctively looked down at myself, and I realized instantly the real source of my discomfort. In my haste to make a speedy exit, I had mistakenly put on a woman's coat, the same deep blue shade as my own, but quite a bit smaller. I hadn't even noticed that it buttoned in the opposite direction. I instantly turned around and headed back up the stairs. I no longer had a deep sense of embarrassment. It was now replaced by a deep sense of anger and rage at all the indignity I had been through. I burst into the waiting room again and instantly had every eye pointed in my direction. I stepped smack into the center of the room and I said out loud, if somewhat indistinctly,
"Yes, that's right. I am wearing a woman's coat. I hope this makes everyone's day. It certainly has made mine."
My coworkers and I decided it would be fun to hire a psychic for an after-hours party. We all agreed that we don't really believe in that kind of crap, but by the time it was all over, all five of my colleagues had completely converted to the cult of Miss Rosa, a bawdy, 60-ish Latina who looked like a drag queen and smelled like curry. I was the only one who left without a firm belief that I could improve my life by summoning St. Jude into a deck of ordinary playing cards. However, I did leave with some helpful observations about how to be a psychic. The following is a list of tips I devised by studying Miss Rosa. 1. Be foreign. It's a cliche, I know, but there's a reason movies always depict fortune tellers as Eastern European gypsies. Wasps barely have enough soul to do the hokey pokey, let alone commune with the spirits of the dead. 2. Get an accent. And I don't mean just any old accent. If you talk like the McKenzie brothers, people will trust you to install their snow tires, but not to divine the secrets of St. Teresa from a deck of Hoyle Mavericks. 3. Accessorize. Another cliche, but very important. Flashy clothing and jewelry will not only contribute to your exotic foreign appearance, if you do it right, you can disorient your clients. And that's a good thing. Miss Rosa reminded me of all those poor little Japanese kids who go into convulsions whenever they watch a particularly eye-boggling episode of Pokemon. I got motion sickness just looking at her. 4. Light candles. Miss Rosa says the saints can't resist them. One whiff of bayberry and they become completely passive. It's like trapping a grizzly. Marlon Perkins would have been a perfect psychic. 5. Look your clients straight in the eye. It'll freak them out, but that's kind of what they're there for. 6. Be vague. Say the kinds of things that are general enough to apply to any of the other 6 billion inhabitants of the planet, but that most people want to think are part of what make them unique. Miss Rosa never said things like, "You worked as a dental hygienist in the Adirondacks for 3 years before moving to coastal Florida to pursue a career as a glassblower." She said things like, "You know someone named John." In fact, she said this to all 6 of us. Ditto for, "You like to have a good time," and "You enjoy good food." Declarations that I took to be absurdly self-evident, but that made my coworkers exclaim in amazement, "Oh my God, that's me to a T!" 7. Punctuate your speech with seemingly meaningful pauses. Miss Rosa never spoke more than 4 words without stopping to concentrate in a way that suggests the saints don't project very well. Example, "You like..." 10-second pause with closed eyes and a deep cleansing inhalation. "To travel." 8. Did I mention be vague? I can't stress this enough. It really seems to be the cornerstone of the clairvoyant trade. Here are some of the things Miss Rosa actually said that impressed my coworkers enough that they were willing to overlook the fact that they appealed to almost every human being that's ever lived. "You're not entirely happy at work. You'd like to live in a bigger place. You like nice things. You're a very perceptive person. You wish you had more money." 9. Don't worry. Your clients will cut you plenty of slack. When Miss Rosa told my coworker Darcy, "There's someone in your life who's causing you concern right now," Darcy said, "Oh my God, that's that creepy teenage boy who's been lurking around my driveway for a week." Miss Rosa, having gotten some information she could run with, warned Darcy to be especially cautious because this evil kid had something planned that very night. As it happens, we hired Miss Rosa on the night of Friday, March 12, 1993, the night of the infamous Storm of the Century that took meteorologists completely by surprise and flooded thousands of coastal Florida homes. when I pointed out at work on Monday that Miss Rosa probably should have been able to see the storm coming, Darcy said she did. How do you figure? I asked. She told me something terrible was going to happen that night, said Darcy, and I got flooded out of my home. She said a teenage boy was going to do something terrible that night, I reminded her. Yeah, said Darcy, but she meant it symbolically. The boy represents the storm because he's so, you know, destructive and all. There was absolutely no way to argue against that kind of reasoning. And that's good news for the aspiring psychic. If your clients have explanatory systems that can turn someone causing you concern into the storm of the century, pretty much anything you say is automatically irrefutable. 10. Maintain a professional appearance at all costs. Another thing that Miss Rosa probably should have sensed is that her husband, who had refused to come inside and had waited for her in the car for 3 hours, was having a heart attack. As the party disbanded, we discovered that he was holding his left arm and struggling to breathe. Miss Rosa, ever concerned about her professional reputation, explained as she got into the car to drive to the hospital, "My powers don't work on family members. Jesus doesn't want that." She backed out of the driveway, stopping briefly to hand us some business cards. "God bless you all," she said, "and don't forget to tell your friends."
This is one of those stories that are so perfect, it's hard to convince people that it's true. But it's completely true, and I was there to observe it. I was at an outdoor music venue in Tampa, Florida, called Skipper's Smokehouse during late January. It was one of those thankfully rare nights during the Tampa winter when it was actually cold. It was so cold, I was dressed in a heavy coat and wore thick gloves. Guitarist and songwriter Clarence Gatemouth Brown, performing on stage, was stopping between songs to cup his tobacco pipe in his hands and draw in hard to create some warmth for his fingers. Despite the cold, he played the guitar like the master that he is. During the break after the first of two sets, I went over to this blazing bonfire that the management had started in an effort to keep the audience warm. As I stood there, enraptured by the soothing heat on my frozen face, who should walk up and stand right beside me but Gatemouth himself? As he held out his hands toward the flames, we made small talk about the unusually cold Florida weather. Gatemouth confided that he had to take a leak badly and asked for directions to the men's room. I offered that since I had to go as well, I would lead the way. We made our way into the empty bathroom, which at that time was a rather crude affair. It had one long tub at which 4 or 5 men could stand and urinate at the same time. We walked up to it, unzipped, and began our business. At almost the same time, a young audience member walked up to the tub on the opposite side of Gatemouth. After a few seconds, he realized he was standing next to one of the great figures in blues and said, "Oh, Mr. Brown, I just want to say how great you are. I watch you and I can't believe it. You make it look so easy." Gatemouth, never looking up from what he was doing, replied instantly,
"Man, I just point the thing. The pee comes out all by itself."
In this episode, The Dentist and the Gatemouth Brown Story were written and performed by yours truly. The Chiclet Pants and How to Be a Psychic were written and performed by my good friend, Bob Waller. And it's his son, Alex Waller, who ends every show by saying,
"And P-Dub holded the microphone."